This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, Nikolai Beilharts back with you for another week of The Country Hour. On the program today, what's the future of the Nationals in New South Wales and federally? As you may have heard, New South Wales election over the course of the weekend, the Nationals lost a number of seats to the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party. One small example of that is the seat that covers Menindee has been lost by the Nationals for the first time in almost 70 years. So we'll talk about that and what's changing regional people's voting habits. Also on the program today, feral goats, smashed avos, literally, and illegal logging. That and plenty more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
To start today, though, the first ever register outlining foreign ownership of water entitlements has been released by the federal government. The register shows one in 10 entitlements is foreign-owned, with China and the United States topping the list. Jessica Schremer reports.
The register compiled by the Australian Tax Office shows 10.4% of Australia's water entitlements are foreign-owned. Chinese and US investors each own 1.9%, followed by the UK owning 1.1%. Majority of foreign-held water entitlements are in the Northern Murray-Darling Basin. Chief Executive of the National Irrigators Council, Steve Wan, says he is not concerned about the report's findings.
The ownership of water is fairly spread out. We've got no particular domination by any country or company, which is reflected in that. We have a high level of ownership from North America and also some from China, but I think that amounts overall to about 1.9%. So it's really not an amount of water which would exercise any influence over the market. And we need to remember that having water entitlements is only valuable for you if it's actually used for a productive purpose.
The register doesn't differentiate between publicly and privately owned water. Riverland vine grape grower Jack Papagiorgio has concerns that there isn't a fair playing field between locals trying to make a living and international investors trying to make a profit.
It is a concern as an irrigator that came to this industry 40 years ago. Water entitlement was part of the purchase of the farm, and the water was part of our asset. And I think we all have to be concerned when we allow foreign ownership of our valuable resources, water. No other country that I know allow us as an Australian citizen to go and buy and able to purchase their water entitlement. Particularly someone like me and many of my fellow growers in all commodities, we've got permanent planting. We've got to have security of our permanent planting, or as we're putting our livelihoods at risk. We cannot accept that.
However, in a statement provided to the ABC, Agriculture Minister David Littleproud said the figures just give information to make good decisions on foreign-owned water going forward. He also said at the moment there is a small percentage of water owned by foreign interests, and much of that is by one property cubby station in Queensland. But the Conservative Party's South Australian Senate candidate Ricky Lambert says that investment from China carries more concern from his party due to state sovereignty.
It shows that China and across the whole nation hold more water than any other national ownership. And we are always pointing out that Chinese foreign ownership is different to other forms like British foreign ownership because it is state-based. The Chinese government has effective control of any company that operates around the world.
More than 1,800 gigalitres of foreign-held water entitlement is within the Murray-Darling Basin. But Professor for Economics John Quiggin says the more important issue is to consider how much water is being drained from the basin rather than who owns it.
And the real problem with water is simply that it's being overused, particularly in the Murray-Darling Basin. And I think that rather than the question of whether the people using it are associated with foreign corporations or not is the issue we should be focused on. I doubt that we're going to see much extension of water ownership in agriculture simply because the kind of large corporate farms represented by Cubby Station are only a minority of the agricultural sector and that's unlikely to change. So I don't see it likely that we're going to see large-scale foreign ownership extending into sectors of the economy that are dominated by family-owned farms.
That's Professor for Economics John Quiggin ending that report from Jessica Schremer. If you want to see more details about who owns water, you can find everything up on our website, abc.net.au/rural.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, over the past month, dozens of ancient dead trees, red gums and live standing trees have illegally been felled from the Lochgarry Wildlife Reserve at Bunbartha in northern Victoria, residents claim the stolen wood is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Speaking to our reporter Mahalia Dobson, resident Kirsty Ramadan, whose property backs onto the wildlife reserve, says it's one of the worst cases of illegal logging she's ever seen.
The last 3 to 4 weeks, we have had massive amounts of trouble with people coming in during the night. So anywhere from 10 o'clock at night to dawn, basically, with chainsaws going all night, for nights on end, and they're taking massive amounts of red gum firewood out in trailer loads. Basically, huge habitat trees, both dead and alive, have been felled at the ground. These are trees with massive girth, so we're looking at, you know, trees that might take 3 or 4 people or more holding hands to link around the diameter of them. They're just felling them at the ground, so just taking them right down. That some of these trees are full of hollows and known habitat trees. We're also in a scar tree area where this is happening for our Indigenous people, so it's got cultural significance, this site, as well, as obviously being very dear to all of us locals who have lived here all our lives. The bushland here is home to us, and it's just being plundered.
What impact will this have on local wildlife as well?
Huge amounts. The trees that are being taken out, like I said, are hollow bearing. Hollows are hard to come by now anyway, and they're taking out a lot of old dead trees that have been standing dead probably since before European settlement. So these trees are absolutely full of large hollows, which a lot of our native bird species and also our mammals use, as well as our reptiles, like our lace monitors. So the stuff they're taking out is irreplaceable.
Have you contacted Parks Victoria about this issue?
Yes, we have. A number of us locals have contacted Parks Victoria. They've tried to rectify the situation and tried to catch people in the act, because it's all during night hours. Obviously, they know parks aren't around. I was told that 2 cameras were set up, one on one of the sites where they assumed they'd be coming back to get firewood out of, and another one was at one of the entry points into the forest, and both those cameras were either vandalised or destroyed basically immediately, so I don't think any footage was gained from that. Some of the vehicles that we've seen, it seems to be 3 vehicles that are regularly seen. Sometimes they have plates on, sometimes they don't, which makes it very difficult for us to get any identification for evidence as well. They definitely know what they're doing. These people, they're using large chainsaws. The trees they're felling are massive. So and they're trying to cover up their tracks by laying bark across the fresh cuts of the stumps that they're leaving scattered throughout the bush. It's whoever's doing it are definitely going to great lengths to hide their trail and sneak in and out while no one's around.
Given such a large amount of wood has been chopped down, do you think the people, whoever it is that are doing this, are going to be using this wood for personal use or perhaps looking to sell it? What's your, I guess, gut instinct on that?
Definitely not. Definitely too much for personal use. This is commercial. These people will be selling it by the metre, selling prime red gum wood, basically, for firewood. Some of the trees, there's been live standing trees felled as well, which I assume they'll intend to come back either next year, or they've got somewhere where they're storing it and they're going to take it out green and let it sit for 12 months, because obviously green wood's not going to be good for burning this winter. So I think they're not only getting wood for right now, for the upcoming cold season, but they're also planning to use wood out of here for following seasons as well, seeing as they're taking down live trees as well as the dead ones.
You've lived in this area for your entire life. Is this the worst case of illegal logging that you've seen during that time?
One of the, it would have to be high up there. The last 2 years we've had trouble with duck shooting during duck shooting season. The shooters taking out huge furniture slabs. But the fines that these people will get, if they're sprung, there is no monetary value put on this wood. There's no value put on the environmental loss of what they're taking out. Basically, this is massive amounts of wood they're taking out. There'd be hundreds and thousands of dollars that they're making off our bushland here.
This land obviously means a lot to you and to a lot of the locals that live around here. How does it make you feel when you see people doing whatever it is that these people are doing, illegally logging trees? How does that make you feel?
Me, on a personal level, it makes me feel sick to the stomach. It hurts, actually. This is a place where I consider my home, and I've lived amongst it and protected it for my entire life. And I know there are other locals that feel exactly the same way.
That's Kirsty Ramadan ending that report from Mahalia Dobson. And Parks Victoria has confirmed these cases of illegal logging and says it's working with Shepparton Police to try and identify and catch the perpetrators.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 16 past 12. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. We're now to a whole new meaning of smashed avos, and this is an instance that probably no one will be a fan of that term. A freak hailstorm has ripped through an avocado orchard in northern New South Wales, destroying 4 million avocados. It's been a tough season for the crop, with prolonged dry conditions meaning water had to be trucked into the property daily. And last month, a raging bushfire threatened the entire place. Colin Foister, told Kim Honan that it was going to be a record crop for the orchard.
Kim, we've just got through the big drought and we could see the rain coming. We were all very excited. So stopped watering the orchard a day before the anticipated rain, but unfortunately it came in the form of hail, so it devastated the crop, as you can see around you, and we've just got to pick up the pieces now.
And so how big were the hailstones?
I wasn't here, but some people have said that they were up to 3 inches and very jagged, but it only hailed for less than 10 minutes. Big enough to knock the fruit off the tree, or if it didn't knock it off the tree, it severely damaged the remaining fruit.
What sort of damage did the hailstorm actually do to the individual fruit? Did it sort of smash the fruit open?
It was severe enough to shatter the fruit, a percentage of it, but 80% of the fruit was just knocked off the tree, and it's 3 months away from harvest, so it's all immature, so it's unsalvageable. And then the remaining fruit on the tree, you know, three quarters of that or more has got up to three or four impact marks from where the hail hit the remaining fruit that didn't get knocked off.
Those impact marks, will that, you know, lead to further damage from that fruit?
Some of it, if it's around the stem, or if it's severe, it will lead to a rot and that fruit then will drop off. But most of it, the remaining fruit on the tree, that 20% that remains on the tree, it'll just be downgraded. So instead of being premium fruit, it'll be a class 2 fruit. So it won't go into a premium 5-kilo tray, it'll go into a 10-kilo bulk box, which you basically get the same money for a 10-kilo bulk of second grade as what you got for a 5-kilo box of premium fruit. So it's halved the value of the remaining fruit as well.
So you've had a pretty tough time. You've managed to get through the drought, a pretty devastating fire through Tabulum a number of weeks ago, and then, you know, for what you expected to be a record crop, for this hailstorm to happen, this freak event, pretty remarkable. How are you feeling?
Well, we haven't got control over the weather. We controlled the other things. We prepared for the bushfire. Fortunately, it was stopped by the RFS before it got this far. And, all praise to them. They did a fantastic job. watering for the drought, we've impacted as much as anybody else. Our water storages were empty. Our bores had reduced in flow to, 30-40% of what they had been doing. So we carted water to supplement what water we had. We grew a good crop. We did what we could that was under our control, but we don't have control over hailstorms, so you can't beat yourself up. You've just got to move on. A bit sad for all my children, all partners in the business together. They've only just started in the last couple of years, so they were all looking forward to our record crop, but it's not to be. But they're young, they'll all bounce back.
How many trees do you actually have here on the orchard in Pretty Gully?
There's around 12,000 mature trees. This is a 100% mature orchard. We planted these trees. The original trees are 20 years old, and the youngest trees are 12 years old. So it's a fully mature orchard.
So how many avocados were you hoping to get off this year?
There was probably 200,000 trays to come off here of premium fruit.
Can you tell me how many avocados that is?
4 million, approximately, I'd say. It's devastating. So my therapy is I'm just get off this farm now. I've assessed the damage and get off this farm and go somewhere else for a month or two and come back and it won't be as apparent.
And Colin, you were pretty happy with the quality of the fruit so far, weren't you?
It's a good area. This area, it's isolated and protected, so we don't have pests and diseases like we have to put up with on a lot of our other farms and a lot of other growers have to deal with. It's protected, so we don't get the wind rub. So it's a high percentage of premium fruit comes off this property.
That's Colin Foister, his Managing Director of Aussie Orchards, speaking there with Kim Honan.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 22 past 12. Dairy farmers in the state's southwest say they're reasonably satisfied with milk prices they're receiving, but they're more concerned about the cost of buying in feed. Many are hanging for an autumn break to get some grass growing as summer pastures run out. Our rural reporter Angus Verley spoke with Chris McKenzie, who farms at Corrymungle near Timboon.
Yeah, let me probably start with sort of, certainly looking for the autumn rain to get going because it's certainly dried off through the latter part of summer and into now, or the early part of autumn. We're calving cows for the autumn calving, and so we want grass, we want feed to come on because there's not an abundance of fodder and around the place, and what is very expensive. So, yeah, we're looking forward to a bit of rain to come pretty soon.
And what's the landscape look like where you are? Have you got any feed left?
Oh, there's just a bit, not a lot, but yeah, it's browning off, and with a couple of showers of rain, put up a green tinge, but sort of, that was about all. But yeah, we're looking forward to something.
So you had a reasonable spring, but it's been pretty dry since then.
Yeah, we came through end of winter, spring sort of was good, set us up all right. We got a couple of very good crops. We're feeding off now, which is a real bonus for us, and so hopefully we can hold until we get the rain.
What crops were those?
Yeah, brassica crops. So we started off with a bit of rape earlier, then into turnips and millet, and that are feeding well and the cows are responding well to.
And have you got much hay or silage on hand, and are you worried that if you do have to buy in feed, are you worried about the cost of it?
Yeah, we've been working through the silage fairly quickly, really, because sort of the shortage of pasture feed. So we're using that, and yeah, we are concerned about the price of fodder, buying in fodder. Latest information from our nutritionist was that prices seem to be going back up a bit, so which is not a real comforting thought. But at the moment, it looks like it's what's happening down the track.
How about the milk price? Are you happy with where it's at?
I guess in our situations, our business, sort of, we'd always like a bit more for that. But, yeah, look, sort of, the autumn prices are reasonable for us. Hopefully sort of, we can get some encouragement as farmers in the industries with a good, reasonable price. And, you know, and sort of with what else has happened through the state with the dryness, it's impacted everybody. So everybody's looking for rain going forward, and hopefully we can keep the confidence up as well, which is probably not all that strong at the moment, but we can work with it.
Con Glennon farms at Noorat, north of Terang. He supplies Fonterra, not out of any sense of loyalty, but because the company's price structure best suits his milk curve. He says it's the input costs that are hurting his business at the moment.
I don't think it's milk prices so much a problem, it's the input costs and compliance and power and everything else that's running for us.
And seasonally, how are you situated, I suppose, compared to where you'd like to be at this time of year?
We're in the stones in there. We're fortunate enough to have a groundwater allocation, which we're using. I mean, we're carving now. You'd be awful game to try that near at dryland without water this time of year. Situation season-wise, autumn was a mongrel last year. Winter was not bad. Spring was fantastic for us. We pile up a lot of fodder, deliberately so. We spread the fert to do it. We've got to stay out of the fodder market. There's just no profit to be made there at all. We're taking a hit on grain price. We're still feeding them, not as much maybe as we were. A bit more careful with young stock and that. We're just on the edge of an autumn break. It's just how it rolls now.
So you said you want to stay out of the fodder market with what you've got on hand. Do you think you will be able to avoid buying any in?
Yeah, by the time we get around to buying something in, there'll be nothing left if it gets that bad. There's a fair bit there around us. And with that extra water and that we've been able to put our hands on and such, we should be right to keep going.
But you are buying in grain?
We are buying in grain at close enough to $500 a tonne by the time it's fed to cows dry. There's no profit in that, but it's sort of a system we're linked into and we'll take a 1 year hit on it.
Okay, so long term you're relatively confident?
Long term we'll be in the game, I'd say. I've got a couple of sons that want to get involved, I've got family involved, I've got a long history and hopefully a very long future. I think the industry's very, very flat. People are from milk clawback prices just getting back on their knees. Things of that nature. We've got no real support from producers that I know of, from processors, yeah. We don't seem to have any of that there. They're here to make a dollar and go home now. That's fine. That's what you buy business for. I understand that. But it's just a change in the mindset of the way we have to do things.
That's Noorat Dairy Farmer Con Glennon speaking there with Angus Furley.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Farmers say they're worried about feral goats spreading diseases to livestock and wrecking the local environment. One family just over the border in southern New South Wales is now volunteering its time to round up the pest. They say one of the silver linings is that its meat is in relatively high demand. ABC South East reporter Daniel Doody caught up with Clint and Brooke Riley.
Dogs.
Clint and Brooke Riley are known as the goat chasers, trekking through the high country with their 8 Kelpie dogs and 2 young kids, Chloe and Jack. The family from Bredbow in New South Wales is helping remove feral goats from properties in the Snowy Mountains and Monaro region.
I'm just started by finding goats on a property that we'd used. We leased it and there was goats there, so we sort of started chasing them and gathering them up from kids as well. Sold them to the abattoirs and...
How long have you been doing it for?
Been doing it for about 10 years, yeah, with my partner, Brooke. So, yeah, we've got a few over the years that we've been doing it.
We used to go out and pretty much catch them before we had any of our dogs and catch them and put them on a trailer, and that's how it kind of started. And put them in a paddock, a bit of a fun thing to do. And then, yeah, we realised they could get, help people out and get money out of it, so we got a few dogs. And
so we muster them up, get them back to the yards, and then take them back to where we have a paddock at home until we get enough to sell. And then we bring them into the sale yards here in Cooma, and from there they go across to the abattoirs in Wodonga.
Feral goats destroy crops and vegetation, causing farmers millions of dollars in losses across the country every year.
Well, goats they destroy their crop as well as wreck the fences and that sort of stuff. And a lot of people believe they carry lice. So it gets in with their sheep, and if they're wool growers, they don't want lice. And all the natives and that sort of stuff, the shrubs and that, they just ruin them with their horns and eat them. And because they're a browser, they'll eat anything. So they'll just, go through, eat crops.
Are there special techniques to catch a group of goats?
because I could imagine that it must be pretty challenging.
It does take a bit of skill, but I think you need main dogs, good dogs. There's sort of normally two of us, and we go on foot because there's like fences and that. They'll just go through a fence. Uphills, steep stuff, you can't really ride horses or motorbikes or anything. The country that we get them out of is too rough. Once we sort of get them out onto the plainer country, where when you've got good dogs and that, you can get a bit of a handle on them and set a set of yards up.
It's a lot of fitness. It's a lot of running and a lot of uphills and downhills and through creeks and stuff like that, and just lifting the yards and stuff. So, yeah, it is pretty physical work.
But for the Rileys, the benefits of rounding up the goats aren't just limited to helping farmers and the environment. They're transported to an abattoir in Wodonga, New South Wales, and then sold for their meat to be exported overseas.
So it works as we send them to the abattoirs and they pay us per kilo when they're dressed, like as a killed weight.
And the farmers, you're providing a free service?
Yes, it's all sort of free. We do it for free if we can take the goats.
And how do the farmers get in touch with you?
There's been a few ways. They contact me directly or go through the local land services in Cooma.
And with so many feral goats still out there causing damage, it's a job that's a long way from being complete for this young family of goat chasers.
We do it mainly for the fun of it, really. Like, it's good fun, and we get a bit out of it too. Like, when we sell the goats, just good fun. It keeps the dogs working, and we enjoy doing it.
That's goat chaser Clint Riley ending that report from Daniel Tootie.
Whether you're up early firing up the machinery, ending your shift, or getting ready for school.
No, I have to.
You have to go to school. You're the principal.
Listen to the ABC Radio Breakfast Team from 6 a.m. each weekday with news, AM, and your local rural report. You'll be ready for your day. ABC Radio Breakfast. It's about where you live.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 29 to 1. Time to get the latest in news headlines now with Sian Johnson. Afternoon, Sian.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. The state member for Polwarth, Richard Reardon, says communities in southwest Victoria are impatient for improvements to Victoria's energy safety regime. The regulator, Energy Safe Victoria, is due to release results into an investigation around the integrity of power poles in the state's southwest this May. The report will examine claims from electricity provider PowerCore that its network is in safe working order a year after a power pole snapped in high winds and caused a fire at Garvok. A cyclist and a motorbike rider have died in two separate accidents around Ballarat over the weekend. Police are investigating the cause of a collision on Creswick Road at Clunes yesterday that left a cyclist, a man in his 60s, dead, and a Harley-Davidson rider who died at the scene of a crash at Mount Mercy yesterday morning is yet to be identified. The Victorian government has vowed to push for one of the world's lowest silica dust exposure limits to protect workers. A Queensland stonemason died 2 weeks ago after developing irreversible lung disease from breathing in tiny particles of silica dust. Gary McFarlane from Eagle Point in Gippsland was a sandblaster for 40 years and now suffers incurable lung cancer. He's urging younger people in the stonemason and sandblasting industry to take their workplace safety seriously. And the Mount Alexander Shire Council has handballed the decision over the Barringup Solar Farm development to the Victorian Planning Minister. Renewable Energy Systems Australia wants to install 260,000 solar panels and a battery storage facility on the 292-hectare site at the Barringup West Road, but many locals have objected. For more news, head to abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Sian Johnson, there with news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster Peter Newham is on duty. Afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
There's a bit of rain around the traps over the course of the weekend. Did anybody end up with anything significant out of it all?
The highest rainfall total in one of our gauges was 116 millimetres at Mount Hotham in the last 24 hours. Now, we're not convinced that's correct because it does stick out a lot from others nearby, but it's not impossible. So we're looking into that. Otherwise, in some of those more elevated areas, there was between 20 and 50 millimetres along the dividing range in the east. So sort of 43 at Mount Buffalo, 41 at Falls Creek, 32 at Harrietville. So it'd be interesting to see if any of your listeners can sort of confirm.
Corroborate it, yes.
Yeah, look, there was sort of 15 to 50 along that dividing range at least. Otherwise, typically, I guess sort of 5 to 20 about the ranges and about the southwest coast. The northwest largely missed out again, and central and east Gippsland had very little. That was with a cold front that moved through last night, and we've had pretty strong winds right across Victoria with that, and we, are persisting with a severe weather warning for sort of South Gippsland, Phillip Island area, the southwest coast, and also the Alps, where we could see wind gusts of 90 to 100 kilometres an hour today. But everywhere is going to be pretty windy. I think most areas will be seeing gusts between 50 and 80 kilometres an hour today with westerly winds. The front's moved away to the east, but there's still showers. There's sort of the areas that typically get are quite showery in a west-southwesterly or in a westerly flow are getting them. So the southwest coast, northeast ranges are getting a bit, and sort of parts of south and west Gippsland look like being quite showery. There's quite a few showers pushing through the Melbourne area right now as well. Central and east Gippsland will largely be dry, and over the northern plains, just isolated showers left today. There is a chance of a thunderstorm near parts of the coast as well, but what we'll see over the next 12 to 24 hours is the winds will gradually ease and showers will contract to the coast and then gradually clear during the day tomorrow. Inland tomorrow it'll be just partly cloudy in the south. In the south it'll be fairly cloudy, but as I said, those showers should contract to the coast and clear during the day, and winds will be much lighter than they are today. As far as temperatures go, it's the coolest day in some time. We had a spell of pretty warm and humid weather, but this front's sort of blasted that humid and warm air away. Maximum's typically just the high or mid to high teens in the south and the low 20s in the north today. Tomorrow it'll be a coolish start, probably the coolest start for some time for a lot of the state. Minimums between 5 and 10, maximums ranging from around 20 in the south tomorrow to the low 20s in the north. And by Wednesday, a high pressure system moves in. It looks like being dry right across the state, mostly sunny, a little bit warmer, temperatures ranging from low 20s in the south to the mid 20s in the north. And Thursday looks like being the warm one this week. Maximums getting into the mid to high 20s right across the state. The wind's tending northerly, a bit of high cloud around, but probably no rain, just a slight chance of a shower or two in the northeast. And then another strong front looks like moving through later Friday. So still getting warm in the north and east ahead of that front, but that front will move across, bringing showers to the state that will persist on the weekend, and it'll be quite a bit cooler next weekend. Quite a contrast to the weekend we've just experienced. Probably temperatures struggling to get above the mid to high teens on Saturday and not dissimilar on Sunday. So a bit up and down over the next week. That really warm and humid weather's passed, but still warming up a bit for Thursday. And some welcome rain for some areas, but unfortunately it looks like the northwest and central and east Gippsland will largely miss out both today and also again with the front on the weekend, on Friday in the weekend.
Okay, and so just before we let you go, that front that is coming through, obviously a long way off yet, but is there expected to be much in it?
Yeah, so it looks like there'll be quite a strong burst of wind, and as far as showers go, the areas that are getting the significant falls with this front will probably get them again. So the northeast ranges in particular, elevated areas, and then south and west Gippsland and the southwest coast sort of area might get sort of 10 to 20 millimetres. There is a fair bit of uncertainty with the strength of that front and how much rain there falls. So obviously we'll update that during the week. One of the models drags a bit of that moisture from ex-cyclone Trevor down ahead of the front on Friday, which could lead to higher falls in the east. But we'll see how that pans out over the next few days. The main message is winds easing over the next 24 hours, showers contracting to the coast and becoming quite settled in the middle part of the week.
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks.
That's Peter Newham, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 21-1. Let's turn to the New South Wales election results. Now, and the focus is really on what happened in regional areas, much more so than what happened in the big cities, like places like Sydney. As you've no doubt heard by now, the Coalition has been returned to government for a third term, but it's suffered massive swings against it in a number of seats in the west of the state. There are two seats still in doubt for the Nationals, Dubbo and Lismore. They could be picked up by an Independent and Labor, but both are too close to call. The loss of either could be a big blow to the Nationals, which already lost two key seats to the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party. Kim Honan reports.
In addition to Shooters, Fishers and Farmers retaining Orange with Philip Donato, the party also picked up Barwon and Murray with convincing wins by cattle farmer Roy Butler and irrigator Helen Dalton. And in those two seats, was the election a referendum on water? Certainly it was a big issue with campaigns around water allocation and quality and claims of mismanagement of water. New South Wales Irrigators Council's CEO Luke Simpkins says yes it was, but for different reasons than Barwon and Murray.
I think that has been much of what the campaign has been about. In the Murray electorate, the lack of access to water, discontent with the Murray-Darling Basin plan was certainly an issue there. And with regard to Murray, a lot of pro-irrigation farming elements were involved with that. Whereas in Barwon, I think it was more about there were probably anti-irrigation farming elements running there. But this is politics.
Well, Helen Dalton from the Shooters, Fishers, Farmers, who picked up Murray once the Murray-Darling Basin plan scrapped for 5 years. And she's also calling for a federal royal commission into water mismanagement. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I think that really the Murray-Darling Basin plan needs to carry on. Let's see how it all goes. You know, we all want more water. We all want more water for irrigation. There are some things that could be done around the edges, but I think the trouble with a Royal Commission is that you'll never know where it will go. And whilst, you know, we, and I'm sure Helen Dalton and a lot of people down in her new electorate would like to see a very socioeconomic basis upon a Royal Commission, the reality is that in this current environment, you know, you're going to have a very strong push for the environmental side of that as well. And I think that these things, they're not going to sit well together.
Luke Simpkins from the New South Wales Irrigators Council. And while there were swings against the Nationals in a number of seats on primary votes, two who performed surprisingly well, increasing their margin, were John Barilaro in Monaro and Adam Marshall in Northern Tablelands, the electorate home to the New South Wales Farmers Association president. James Jackson says he's not surprised with the weekend results across the state and was delighted to see a focus back on the bush during the campaign.
The bush has probably been neglected by all political parties. I mean, the level of our services and infrastructure, you know, over the last probably 30 years has been under the money. I mean, this was one election where, you know, New South Wales didn't own Newcastle, Sydney and Wollongong, and we were delighted that the focus was back on regional New South Wales, because there's a backlog of infrastructure and, you know, services have got to get up to scratch in rural New South Wales.
Now that the Coalition has been returned to government, what are the key commitments that it has made to New South Wales farmers that you're going to make sure are met in the short term and, you know, the next 4 years?
Well, certainly the roads and bridges, $1.5 billion worth of roads and bridges. You know, the infrastructure spend is needed out there. There's still a lot of timber bridges. You know, we've got to get B-doubles around the state. Getting that rail network up, the regional rail network up to 25-tonne axle load limit. You know, getting boxed grain into Newcastle, you know, sorting that issue out. Wyongla Dam at the top of the Lachlan River there, the promise on some water infrastructure, they're raising the level of the dam. You know, the doubling the capacity of the road over the Blue Mountains to connect that Western Sydney ag precinct around the airport. There's all sorts of visionary things that they've actually put in this election. But if we get them kicked off, you know, I think agriculture will be better off. We'll be better placed to survive the next drought. We just hope that they can bring with them a bit of rain too.
That's James Jackson from New South Wales, ending a New South Wales Farmers Association, I should say, ending that report by Kim Honan. Another interesting note from the fallout of the New South Wales state election is that Niall Blair has announced he'll be resigning from Cabinet and stepping down as Deputy Leader of the New South Wales Nationals. Now, that, of course, means he will no longer be the Agriculture Minister or the Minister for Regional Water in New South Wales. In a statement that he released, he said, while the opportunities of public life have been immense, he sees the costs personally and more recently professionally have taken their toll on him. He says, interestingly of note, that the level of aggression directed towards him around water policy had a profound impact on his decision as well. And you can find more details on that online as well. abc.net.au/rural. It's 12:45 here on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. My name is Nikolai Bailharts. Now let's turn to Tasmania's ban on genetically modified crops. It's up for review and is prompting quite strong debate in the island state, and has also raised questions about what the potential ramifications would be for those on the mainland, including in Victoria, if a GM ban in the state was lifted. The Tasmanian government says it's about protecting brand Tasmania, but not everybody seems to agree. Hugh Hogan has the story.
Genetically modified, or GM, crops have been grown in Australia for some time. GM cotton, canola and safflower are all commercially grown on the mainland. Tasmania, South Australia and the ACT have a ban on all GMOs. Poppy farmer Rick Rockliffe says the ban puts Tasmanian farmers at a disadvantage.
Look, I'm pro-GMO and always have been. I think the advantages to mankind of GMO are unlimited. There's huge potential. There's opportunities to produce drought-resistant genes into plants to make them better able to cope with that. And I think to turn our back on that sort of science is a sorry state of affairs, really. I think we should use science to our full advantage. We talk about being the clever state, but in some areas we're not very clever. Tasmanian Alkaloids, who I used to work for, produced a GMO poppy probably at least 30 years ago now, which was resistant to Basta, which is a common herbicide, and had the advantage we could have sprayed the poppy crops with one spray of Basta, killed all the weeds, including the wild poppy, which are still the wild poppy is still a very significant challenge for the poppy industry in Tasmania. Whereas now we're spraying poppies with lots of different sprays to produce a crop with Basta, just one simple cheap herbicide, so it would significantly reduce the cost of growing poppies and therefore the growers' returns.
20 years ago, Rick Rockliffe was lobbying to lift the ban. He says it's been 20 years of lost opportunities for Tasmanian farmers.
It was so difficult politically in Tasmania. My former company decided not to pursue it because we could have expended a lot of energy and not made much progress. So we just waited for the world to move on and catch up, I guess, but so far that hasn't happened. The thing about it might affect Tasmanian markets, but I'm not convinced about that. I just go back to my original point that the advantages, potential advantages, are so immense from GMO. To ignore the science is just being Luddites. I see from a marketing perspective, it could be difficult, but I'm sure eventually those fears will be put aside. We produce an abundance of interesting different food types here. The fact that one or two crops are GMO, I can't see how that can really affect that.
Other industries in Tasmania are benefiting from the GM-free status.
We're a niche producer and we're GMO-free and we should keep it that way.
Peter Norris is the Vice President of the Tasmanian Beekeepers Association. He told Fiona Breen the ban on genetically modified organisms is essential for honey export markets.
It would destroy our markets in Europe. They're very anti-GMOs, and if any GMO pollens were detected in our honeys that we export to Europe, that would mean that they would stop importing our honey.
So are there bans on imports of honey that have traces of GMO?
Yes, quite so. Until the world opinion is changed and the world is ready to accept GMOs, then we're in a position where we shouldn't go down the road of everybody else. We should maximise our marketing advantage. We're a niche producer. And we're GMO-free, and we should keep it that way.
Is Europe a big market for Tasmanian honey?
Yes, it is. It's not the biggest, but it is a big market.
And they demand GMO-free honey?
Absolutely.
Is your organisation planning to put a submission into the government review?
Absolutely, yes. We've started talking about that today. And we have a meeting on Friday week and it'll come up for discussion there.
How would honey be affected by genetically modified crops?
Well, the pollens from genetically modified organisms, they end up in the honey and they're detectable quite easily through microscopical analysis. And if they are detected, then they'll reject our honey.
There's no chance of compromise as far as the honey industry is concerned?
Well, no, we don't want it at all. It'd be just the ruination of that market.
What's your feelings about the government's perspective? Have you had a chance to talk to anyone?
No, I haven't yet. But I hope that they will stick with the ban that they have in place at the moment.
How important is the honey industry to Tasmania generally?
As a just a pure honey production, we're a fairly small industry. We contribute about $20 million to the economy. Our industry supports a bigger industry in the fruit industries, the pome fruit, the stone fruit, the berries, and also the seed industries. Carrot seed is becoming a really big product produced here in Tasmania. And the hives that are needed for the pollination in those industries are dependent on honey as well. I mean, we can't just survive on pollination, but we need to have honey as another string to our bow, and we don't want to have that market diluted at all.
South Australia is also reviewing its GM-free status. A report prepared by the University of Adelaide's agricultural economist Kim Anderson says the ban has cost farmers more than $33 million between 2004 and 2018 and will cost them a further $5 million over the next 6 years. The Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association says it's asked the government for evidence about the benefits of being GMO-free.
We've had conversations with ministers in the past asking for Department of Ag Primary to do that analysis for us, and we haven't seen that data come forward yet. We want to make sure that, or we'd like to know that our producers are getting a premium for being GMO-free when potentially there's the chance to grow genetically modified plants in the state, which could benefit our farmers.
Hugh Hogan ending that report.
You're with the Country Hour, on air, online, and on the move. Join in today's broadcast at abc.net.au/rural.
It is 9 to 1. Well, quite often you'll hear a story about a fascinating agricultural research being done, but some of the criticism is that then you don't see any practical use of it on farm. Well, it's not the case with this next story. A couple of years ago, researchers got together to ask the question, could robots and satellites be used to map every mango, macadamia and avocado tree in Australia? Turns out the answer has been yes. Dr. James Underwood was one of those people. He's now co-founded a tech startup called Green Atlas to help farmers count every flower and fruit in their orchard digitally. He told Kelly Buchanan he's trying to answer a rather fundamentally difficult question. Can it be done on a commercial scale?
How can we affordably map every flower and fruit in the whole country, for example? And this really required a whole new engineering approach to get that right. You know, it's funny because like for the last several years, I've been talking at industry conferences around Australia and people would always ask, you know, when is it possible to do this commercially? And for many years, I've basically been saying, oh, you know, it's about 2 years off. So I'm pretty pleased to be able to finally say that this is now commercially available.
It is interesting because we often see this kind of research work done and very little practical application. Since you have launched Green Atlas, how has your new technology been used?
We chose to start applying it to apples and for apple growers. And this is because it's where the initial kind of use cases and economics made, I guess, the most immediate sense. And so our first customers are distributed throughout New South Wales and Victoria. But our plan this year as we scale up the business is to address other fruit and nut varieties as well. And we've actually had quite a bit of international interest as well, which speaks to the kind of global demand, I guess, for solutions in this space. And you know, but we're keen to keep deploying in Australia to start off with.
So what kinds of changes have you seen on the farms that you've been able to work with?
I guess no matter how well managed an orchard is, and our customers do include some of the, you know, absolute top growers in this country, there's always this variability between orchard blocks and within blocks that, you know, really throughout the different stages in the season. And it's essentially like Mother Nature 101, right, that causes that variability. And at some level, it's kind of impossible to avoid, but that variability can be managed. So the data that we provide gives visibility on this and essentially allows growers to see exactly what's going on, you know, all laid out in front of them. And I guess, you know, typically our customers already understand that this variability exists and they have some approaches to address it. But seeing it all laid out like that really simplifies precision management, especially when you have a lot of hectares, you know, under management. So it's, you know, it's a process of moving away, I guess, from driving around in your ute and looking at the trees, maybe making some notes on a pad, maybe taking a few photographs, to instead having like a much more streamlined digital workflow where, you know, it's all scanned, recorded, available for inspection, for comparison from one year to the next and so on. So it's still driving around looking at the trees like before, but it's much more of a kind of meticulous, digital, thorough kind of way of doing that. And so, you know, it doesn't circumvent the growers needing to have experience and boots on the ground and that kind of thing, but it makes part of the process much easier for them to manage. And so that's, you know, the sort of big picture, I guess. And, you know, to bring it down to a couple of more specific examples, like at the start of the apple season during flowering, the data that we provide helps them plan for spray thinning and flower pruning and so on, which is a necessary part of how they, in apples in particular, how you kind of manage the crop load and get that uniform distribution that you want that leads to good quality fruit. And, you know, to track how well that process is working through the season. And then at the end of the season, the fruit maps and yield estimates that we provide, they kind of give a retrospective on how well you've done and that sort of thing. And this can also lead into changes to make in the following year, given how the crop can be, you know, biennially bearing, meaning what happens in one year affects what happens the following year and so on.
That's Dr. James Underwood from Grain Atlas speaking there with Kelly Buchanan. And that does mean it is time to head off to the livestock market, starting today at Mortlake with Caroline Ronald.
Good afternoon. Agents penned another small yarding of 278 cattle. Extra buyers joined the regular team with strong competition resulting in a stronger market trend across most categories. Steers to the trade lifted up to 13 cents, 241 to 280. Heifers to the trade jumped 35 cents, 241 to 275. Feeder steers, 205 to 235, firm to slightly cheaper. Feeder heifers, 220 to 258, 12 cents dearer. Grown steers and bullocks lifted 7 cents in places, 240 to 284. Grown heifers, 240 to 255, lifted 7 cents. Tops of the beef cows jumped 35 cents, 195 to 231, with the medium D2 and D3 types lifting 4 to 21 cents, 140 to 184. Bull sold to the usual buying group in a stronger market. Better shape selling between 212 to 226. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA.
Thanks, Caroline. And now to Leanne Dax at Wagga.
Numbers dipped by almost 1,000 with 2,100 cattle yarded at Wagga. Most of the offering was secondary cattle suitable for lot feeders and restockers. The promise of rain made the cow sale a feature with prices surging 50 cents, some sales 70 cents. Feeder steers improved 20, feeder heifers lifted 24, weaner steers back to the paddock 10 to 15 cents better. A few veal, 238 to 275. Trade steers, too few to quote, 290 to 311. Trade heifers, 244 to 306. Only a limited few have sold to the trade. Feeder heifers, $2 to 276. Feeder steers, 250 to 299. Restocking steers out to 304. Heavy steers and bullocks, 215 to 278. Heavy cows, 189 to 224. The middle run of D2 and D3s, 142 to 185. Store cows for the framier end, 140 to 170. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And now to Jenny Kelly at Bendigo.
Good afternoon. Slight reduction in lamb numbers to 12,000 head, but a step up in demand across the buying ranks led to a dearer market. The heaviest lambs gained $10 to $25, while domestic lambs improved by $5 to $10. Export lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight sold for a top of $208, with four pens over $200. As a comparison, similar lambs last week reached just 184. Heavy lambs 26 to 30 kilos made from 177 to 199 to average 185. The next grade down at 24 to 26 kilos, 166 to 178 to average 171. These heavy lambs were tracking around 650 cents a kilo. The strongest competition was for neat trade weights. The best 22 to 24 kilo lambs made from 157 to 175 to average $165 a head, working out at 670 to 680 cents, with some pens over 700 cents. The sweetest light trade lambs, around 20 kilos, made up to $145 at over $7, but they had to be good to be at this money. Plain to light lambs mostly 115 to 138. The mutton market took off today. Heavy crossbred merino ewes lifting by $12 to $30. Heavy merino ewes 120 to 155 at an estimated 480 cents a kilo carcass weight. Big crossbred ewes 148 to $178. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks very much, Jenny. That's the Country Hour for today. Just to remind you, you can find details of all of our stories up on our website, including those details of who owns water entitlements in Australia and some of the ongoing ramifications for the Nationals as a result of the New South Wales state election over the course of the weekend. abc.net.au/rural.